Excuse me, everyone. This is the operator. Need to inform all participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. I'll do a quick roll call. Good morning, good evening to everyone. On today's call, we have Mark Partridge, Jeff Newman, David Maher, Paul McGrady, Konstantinos Komaitis, Jeff Eckhouse, Olivier Crépin-Leblanc, Robin Gross, Kathy Kleinman, John Nevitt, Wendy Seltzer. From staff, we have Margie Milam, Marika Konings, Amy Stratos, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White, and we have apologies from Alan Greenberg and Maye Diop. If I could also please just remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you.
Thank you. This is David. I'd like to start off with a couple of housekeeping details. Tomorrow, the call is scheduled for a time, I believe it's 10 o'clock Central Time, and I'm not sure what that is, UTC. Unfortunately, I have a serious conflict, and I've asked John Nevitt to step in and act as chair pro tem of that meeting. For this meeting, we're looking at the Common Ground paper as it was revised on November 5th, and I believe Kathy Kleinman sent out a further revision, but we don't have that up yet.
David, may I? No, I sent out, the one I sent out was exactly what I sent to you on Friday.
Oh, okay. Well, then we're all looking at the same document.
Thank you.
Having gone through both the URS and the clearinghouse items in our previous calls and having identified people's positions and the issues, I think it's time to start thinking about how we're going to do our job, which is arriving at a consensus to the extent it's possible. As a proposal, would say that we ought to have a draft document of some kind, a straw man, so-called. I see we already have some hands up. Olivier, go ahead.
Just before we start, as a matter of housekeeping, Alan Greenberg is not on the call, so I'm taking his place as the ALEC main person. If he joins, he'll be the ALEC alternate. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Olivier. Mark?
I wanted to just point out that we just moments ago, the IPC circulated an edited version of the chart with an updated comments from the IPC. They're essentially, as we discussed last week, with some changes. I think they're primarily changes of nuance rather than anything dramatic, but I just wanted to put that on the record, that it's there.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So far as getting a draft together, one idea would be to ask Margie to collect the areas where there is already agreement, and areas where there's still disagreement, and give us some kind of document to work with. Any thoughts on that, Margie? Is that something you could do?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Then let's get started. This call is devoted to the URS. I think the issue of mandatory is still in dispute, or there's no consensus. Does anyone, Paul?
Well, this is, this is our number one issue, and we've gone through the chart, and we have a sense of where people are on various issues. So the mandatory issue is tabled for that process. But on here is it's them looking at the updated chart. It looks like everybody is in agreement on this point, except for the non-commercial folks. And before we go any further, I'd just like to hear from them about, you know, what their concerns are. Those have not been expressed. And so we'd like to hear what those are so that we can see how far we are on this point, because, frankly, unless the URS is mandatory, we're negotiating over the details over a hypothetical mechanism that's really not going to do much good. So if possible, can we hear from the one group as identified as saying no to mandatory?
Okay. Mark has his hand up, but Kathy, I believe, volunteering on this.
Absolutely. There, and I urge the other members of the NCSG drafting team to speak up as well, because this is a very important question. It's one we've been giving a lot of consideration to, and a lot of internal discussion. And we are very, very, very concerned about the process issues here. We're concerned about the 20 days notice, appropriate notice to registrants. We're concerned about the examining process. We'd like to see three-person independent examiners with diverse backgrounds really evaluating these complaints to see if there is this clear-cut abuse that is so obvious to everyone. We want to see appropriate appeal. We want to see randomization of the forms. No more forum shopping. If the checks and balances come into the system, then we've discussed that mandatory might be something we could really consider. And so I wanted to share that, but our reservation is with the entire process and with fairness and checks and balances. And again, I'd urge other members of the drafting team of the NCSG drafting team to respond as well.
Okay, I don't see any hands up, but I think that's clear enough that this is, again, as the last week, it's an issue that is dependent on the outcome of other issues that we face. And so that there's the possibility of consensus, but it depends on resolving the other questions. Why don't we just move on then? Mark?
No, I'll take my hand down. That's okay.
Okay.
It's okay.
And then the next issue is the purpose, garden variety cyber squatting. And again, the question seems to be raised by the non-commercial. Kathy, do you want to speak to this again?
Sure. I think we're revisiting where we were last week as well, that there's a real concern about defining what a genuine non-contestable issue is, what clear and convincing and clear-cut cases of infringement look like, creating something very narrow and very defined so that you know it when you see it. And I haven't seen that type of description come forward yet. So we're amenable to watching for it and to better understanding. I think this is a place where lots and lots of dialogue is going to be appropriate, and maybe even face-to-face meetings to really thrash out what this is going to look like, because this is the key element of the URS, at least from our perspective.
Constantino?
Yes, just to add another point to what Kathy has said, another concern that we have is that we've heard exactly the same justification used for the UDRP. So we are still struggling to understand what are these clear-cut cases that we have been referring to. So we would like a more precise definition of what it is really that the URS, the cases that the URS is meant to cover.
Okay. Mark.
the clear-cut cases that the URS is meant to cover are those cases where there's no defense. The UDRP doesn't adequately deal with them now because it involves a more complicated, time-consuming, and expensive process. The problems that have arisen over the last many years in many ways weren't anticipated in the original design of the UDRP. So we're taking cases that would under the same elements as the UDRP, but they're to be decided by clear and convincing evidence with no contestable issue, meaning there's no defense. And you know, for practicing lawyers throughout the world, that's a clear standard to deal with a decision. If you look at it and say this is a complicated case, it takes more time to decide, there's a defense, then it shouldn't be decided under the URS. The case should be rejected. But there's a huge number of problems, documented problems, that are going through the UDRP process now, where they're decided by default and there's no contestable issue. They should be handled faster, more cheaply, and not require defensive registration maintenance by the complainant. So that's the point behind this, and it seems pretty straightforward and clear.
Okay. Before going on to the various people who have their hands up, how does this fit into the request, the assignment we have from the GNSO Council? Is in the staff explanation of the differences between the staff recommendations and the IRT, is the purpose there an issue? Is this a question that we really have to decide at this time?
I would say that the purpose isn't an issue between the staff report and the other proposals that have been put on the table. It's not a difference between the IRT. I think at the Kathy and others have pointed out that there's some safeguards in the IRT proposal in terms of process and procedure that aren't in the staff report that they and others, including the IPC, favor. But I don't think there's a question of purpose.
Hey, Kathy, is your hand up?
Yes, I wanted to ask Mark or whoever would like to take it a question, which is a single park domain name, no pattern, we're not talking about no pattern of misconduct associated with the registrant, a single park domain name where there's an overlapping use of some basic word. We can assume it's trademarked a million times over, but also a generic, ordinary dictionary word. Single park domain name, is that a case of clear-cut infringement?
Well, I guess that was directed to me to answer, and I'd put on my UDRP panelist hat, and the question under the standard under the UDRP is whether it is more likely than not that this is an abuse, and that depends on the specific mark in question. If the word is a common, ordinary word, house, for example, probably there's a defense. If there's terms there and it's used for a park page, but the term is coined and arbitrary, that probably is clear.
Doesn't
it's hard
really
to answer in the abstract.
Doesn't it really depend if it's a case where someone is put up or bought the registration, and it's clearly a trademark infringement. and they default, that's in the URS case. But if there is any question and there's a defense, then it goes out of the URS. Wendy, you have your hand up.
Thanks. One of the points that the non-commercial group has emphasized is that I think echoed by what I heard Mark saying, that there are cases that the UDRP deals with poorly, and while the URS is a quick attempt to solve them, we'd be better off solving them uniformly by fixing the UDRP to be applicable to all domains, not just new GTLDs, and all registrations invoking this clear wrongdoing. So I think that's why the non-commercials have suggested either a sunset for the URS coupled with a review and amendment to the UDRP planned, or a new PDP on UDRP review, so that we can take the lessons from UDRP's failures, lessons from an early implementation of URS, and combine them into a rapid system that serves the needs of domain registrants and trademark holders.
Okay. Zahid?
Thank you. I'll let Mark or Paul correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding of what actually falls under the URS or what doesn't necessarily depend on the sort of claim you're taking to the URS. It depends more, I think, maybe on the answer. And it basically, there's a complaint which seems like, which is a trademark dispute or even a UDRP, regular dispute. If there is a answer, and if you look at the forms, and what I've just done a few minutes ago is send out the forms in one small Word document so that maybe it'll help many of the people who are on the group see what it was that the IRT recommended, you'll see that if you can just tick off a defense and give just a few lines as to what your defense is, effectively what that will do is, if it's a The URS examiner is not going to look into whether or not this is a case which has been proved or proof has been tendered, but only look at the fact saying, okay, it has a defense been made out. Is there a contestable case here? And if it is, then that should be tackled in a different form, either in a court or at a UDRP, where the complainant would have to prove his case and the defense would have to prove its contentions as well. So automatically, I think it's really not a question of what actually is covered by the URS, as opposed to maybe, and this is, I mean, again, as I said, as Mark explained, if I'm incorrect, I can be corrected here, but the answer and the defense put up most of the times will decide whether the dispute stays within the URS or is kicked out and will go to UDRP or to the court. And I think that is a safety provision as well, because a respondent in the URS can actually literally just tick a box, put in a couple of lines about what his defense is, and just like you would be able to do that in a summary jurisdiction where a defense is put up and it's not scrutinized in detail, but the judge looks at it and says, yes, this is an arguable case. We don't know whether this will win or not, but summary judgment is denied. And I think that's what we're trying to basically get at, and that's my two cents for that. As far as the sunsetting of the URS is concerned, there's just one concern that is raised, that if the URS was to sunset and the UDRP didn't actually go through a process where it was upgraded, if you will, or reviewed again and reformed, you would be left with a void, and I don't know what would fill that void. You might have new GTLDs and sort of running along, and there's a sunset of the URS, and you've got nothing there to protect it. And that is just one concern that I would have. Just want to comment on that.
Okay. Olivier?
Thank you. I think that one thing that we're all trying to build here is a URS that is fair for everyone, both for registrants, intellectual property owners, etc. But the discussion we're having right now seems, as far as I'm concerned, to be more operational than actually answering the questions which are on this table. The operational details, well, if I could suggest perhaps that we agree on what we have here and then work out operational details that will make this URS fair for everyone, then we'll probably have something where we have consensus on a first document, provided the document, the URS itself will be fair operationally. Is that something that we can work with?
That sounds like a very good question. Jeff Newman.
Yeah, thanks. So my question is really for Kathy, for Wendy, and others. I've heard the IP guys try to define a standard. Kathy and Wendy, can you define a standard that you could accept? Is there, have you guys given that some thought? And what would be kind of the exact words you'd like to see? You know, look, I'm in the registry constituency, and I don't really feel like this is a hugely important issue for the registries as to what the standard is. So I'm trying to listen to both sides and kind of come up with what I think would be a good compromise. But I've heard, so we've heard what the business and IP guys have said. Really helpful if you guys could suggest some wording or something that you all would find acceptable.
Kathy, do you want to respond to that?
I think Wendy might want to go first, and then I'll respond as well.
Okay, Wendy.
Sure. I think backed by procedural safeguards, which are a critical part of making the substantive rule fair, I think a rule like the 12b6 motion to dismiss standard of a federal complaint. Does it state a cause of action, and But of course, we're applying that standard to the on the other side, to the defendant. Is there a claim that could be stated on the defendant's behalf, or if there is no such claim, then the complaint stands. So we've heard tossed around serial cyber squatting as what this is intended to combat. If the defendant registrant can be shown to be a serial cyber squatter and has nothing to offer in his or her defense, then that's a complaint that can go through URS, provided that the registrant has the opportunity to challenge if that complaint was made incorrectly, leaves out material facts, or never reached the registrant with notice at all.
Okay. I think it would be helpful if that could be reduced to writing as a standard that would fit into the purpose question. Phil Corwin.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe it might be helpful to try to define what the elements are, because to say it's a case with no defense, the complainant brings the case. He may think there's no defense, but the complainant cannot know for sure whether or not there is a defense before filing the case. And I don't see anywhere on the grid the elements that need to be proved. Maybe there's consensus on that. My understanding was that the elements were identical to the UDRP, other than the requirement for a registered mark and a higher evidentiary standard, but I don't see them on the grid, and I'm just want to raise the question of whether the elements are satisfactory, whether there's consensus on that, because it seems to me that's more important, and that's really what's going to define whether a finding can be made against a registrant, not no defense for which no one can be sure when they file a case whether or not there is one.
Mark?
Well, I think Phil said it right, is that, that what's contemplated is that the elements are the UDRP elements, but that the standard is heightened, and I think Wendy put it well by referring to the 12B6 standard, which is essentially the summary judgment standard. And that's what was in the mind of people who worked on this from the IRT point of view, and I think that's largely carried over to the staff proposal, although the staff proposal used the clear and convincing evidence standard without stating the no contestable issue standard.
Okay. It seems to me that we may have exhausted this subject, at least for the time being, that what we need is a written statement on the standard, and if we can get that and work on it, we might be close to a consensus. Does anyone still want to speak to this? I see Jeff, Kathy, Phil have your hands up.
I do, David.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Okay. I still think we need to work on the elements here, and I'm going to second Phil on that, because we promised our constituency that the URS would not be a bypass to the UDRP, that it was for a different purpose, that it was for narrower and more limited purposes. So you can't throw it open to the same UDRP test and then just require a higher burden of proof, and I've talked about this throughout Seoul. You really have to have elements that make it clear to the complainant as well as to the registrant what it is the URS is for. Make it clear, define the elements, define this as the more clear-cut abuse, but put that into the elements and then raise the burden of proof. Raising the burden of proof alone doesn't do anything, and neither does a more likely or not standard that Mark raised. I think we can get these elements narrowed down, but the URS and the UDRP shouldn't be two paths to the same goal.
Okay, Jeff. Jeff Newman.
Yeah, just quickly, I feel like we're playing a game of chicken and egg here. We're going around in circles. When we talk about the standard, people say, let's just talk about the elements. When we talk about the elements, then people bring up, well, let's talk about the standard. So I just want to note that for the record. I agree we should talk about the elements, but am I the only one that feels like this is going in a circle?
No, I think you're probably right. Mark?
Well, we're concerned about, the IPC is concerned about Kathy's comment about the elements. We think the point of dealing with the elements is in the evaluation stage, that would address her concerns, but trying to capture some sort of narrow focus at the top of the funnel as to what comes in this largely has the potential of defeating the purpose as this was intended and being problematic for dealing with new problems as they arise. People are very creative about these things, and if you start having very narrow elements, the cyber squatters will work around them. Kathy and I have had this conversation before, and I think it would be good to focus on at the decision stage as to what elements or what safe harbors there might be for people who would not be violating this, but I think it would be a mistake to narrow the funnel and defeat the purpose of this, which is to provide something that will quickly deal with those, primarily with the default cases in clear instances of abuse.
Okay. I see Kathy and Jeff have your hands up. I'll
put mine down, sorry.
Yeah, okay. Hey, David, just a quick clarification, because I see it's in the notes. I think Wendy meant Rule 56 instead of 12B6, which is the summary judgment motion as opposed to the initial pleading. So,
well,
as long as
okay.
Correct.
But 12B6 is turns into a summary judgment if you have evidence.
I know. I'm just for the notes perspective. We don't have to get into that. Just
let's skip over the fine points of federal civil procedure.
David, can I have a question?
The idea is, I think, in front of us. Should we move on to the appeal?
David, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is there anyone who would want to take offline a discussion about what the elements and the standards should be?
I think it would be that's fine if people want to do that offline, but wouldn't it be better if the non-commercial group could put down in writing what it believes to be essential here so that we're not chasing our tail on these issues?
It would certainly help to have a comprehensive list of, because I'm not sure we all agree on clear and convincing and what those cases of infringement are. So to work with IPC and business on really clear-cut examples of what you're looking for in this, what you expect to capture in this, would be very helpful.
Well, can the non-commercial group do that?
Again, asking to work with IPC and BC on the very specific examples for what the URS is created for, what they want it for. Since we're not the ones asking for this proceeding, it would be helpful to work with anybody who wants to work offline on this.
Well, I have a concern here. We are faced with a very short deadline. Either we come to a consensus or the ICANN board has said they will put into place the staff proposals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's default. And I think at this point, if the non-commercial group has some serious concerns about the default and the way it might be applied, I'd like to suggest that the burden is on you to come up with some definitions that you believe will work. And then work with the other groups that may have different views. But I'm thinking of the looming presence of what will happen if we don't find consensus. John, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thanks, David. I just want to agree with you on what you just said and also echo a prior comment that Jeff said. When we're looking at, we have to look at this differently between the elements and the standard. When Kathy just spoke, she talked about what the IPC and the BC might consider clear and convincing evidence. That doesn't go to the elements, that goes to the standard. So if we are opening up the elements of the UDRP, that's going to be a lot longer process. So I would recommend we keep the elements the way they are. It's what the IRT recommended, it's what the staff recommended. It's, most of the groups seem to say, let's not open the elements of the UDRP. Let's, we could do a UDRP review, and that's certainly something we'll talk about later in this call, and we could do a URS review. But to open the Pandora's box of the elements at this point is a mistake. We should just stick to what the standard is to prove those elements.
All right. I agree with that. Okay, let's move on to the de novo appeal. We seem to have, at least according to our chart, a consensus on the concept of an appeal. Does anyone want to speak to this? Or should we just move on? Mark.
Yeah, I think the chart may not fully deal with the nuances of the parties' positions here. The IRT view of appeal was that it would go to the ombudsman, not as a de novo review. Or that it could go to court as a de novo review. And I'm not sure that I think that's a view that makes good sense, but I'm not sure that that's what everybody has in mind.
Kathy?
Yes, as the NCSG column shows, we really think that this appeal process is critical to the checks and balances of the system, not an ombudsman, but a real appeal. And in fact, the IRT even had one for default, had a de novo appeal, which we have embraced as well. But also that let's put in, you know, an appeal for review on the merits, an appeal if there's a question of the impartiality or abuse of discretion by the examiner. Let's add some teeth to the abusive claim by the complainant. If there's an abuse, we never flesh this out well with reverse domain name hijacking in the UDRP. Let's do it here. And, of course, honesty before the forum. If there's perjury, if there's lying, there should be an appeal on that, and the claimant should be kicked out of the process permanently. Basic fairness, and the appeal can go a long way towards making that happen.
Okay, Jeff?
Yeah, and Mark and John can keep me honest here. I think some of the concerns expressed by the IRT were that I don't think there was an opposition to an appeal process. I think it was more that they were worried that someone would just appeal automatically if it meant that their name would go off of hold and become live in order to get the extra few days, weeks, months of monetization out of the name. So if there's a way to address that, which I believe there are ways to do that with certain penalties against abusive appeals, I guess on the other side of what Kathy's saying, then I think, at least it was my impression that the IRT might not have cared as much or may not be so a stronghold on this. So if we can address those small concerns, large concerns but small details, I think that might go a long way.
Thanks. Constantino.
Yes, I would like to basically go back to the ombudsman issue. I think that the ombudsman is a separate body within ICANN dealing with procedural issues and decisions made by ICANN and other people being not satisfied with it. The ombudsman has zero expertise on trademark issues, and I don't really see how an ombudsman would be able to deal with an appeals process that comes down to basic issues of trademark law. This is not an appeal. My understanding of the appeal, at least, is to have the appellate body within the system that you're about to create in order to provide very good checks and balances and to give parties the opportunity for due process and to go back, reopen the case, and challenge, basically, the decision.
David? Mark?
This is Amy Staffis. May I speak to that for a second?
Go ahead.
Yeah, just to clarify, not with respect to the ombudsman concept, but if there was an ombudsman implied into this process, it would not be the ICANN ombudsman. That would be a completely different process. That's it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Mark.
Well, what I'm going to say echoes that. The concept was not that this went to the ICANN ombudsman, but that there was a specific person within the URS process, a supervising attorney or some such position who would review upon request and make this decision. So it would be somebody who was knowledgeable about the process and knowledgeable about the relevant law. That was okay. The concept.
Thanks. Kathy, did you speak to that?
No, let me lower my hand right now, but I did want to speak to something about the panels when we get to it, which seems to be also under the appeals area, just what a panel should look like. But I'll wait till after we finish talking about appeals.
Well, the next item is the question of the notice, where I think there is general agreement. Then item 16 is panelists being randomized. Is that the issue you want to talk about?
I wanted to, on the appeals, we had talked about the NCSG had, again, is advocating for a full appellate process because we think it makes sense. When we're dealing with this type of rapid review, that's where the balance is going to be, is having an appeals process, and we recommend a three-judge panel And one would be a trademark expert, one would be a fair use expert, one would be an academic or a DNS expert. And that would be more substantive and more authoritative, I think, than an ombudsman and more definitive. But also for the original review of the process, rather than having one person decide what in his or her opinion is clear-cut abuse, we're still trying to figure out what it is. And again, no one can give us exact elements of it. We'll be working on that as NCUC. But why not have three people meeting independently? Don't call it a panel. They don't have to correspond and probably shouldn't. But again, a trademark expert, a fair use expert, and an academic independently sitting in front of these stacks of URS complaints and looking and seeing whether they, you know, when they spend their 10 minutes on each one, and that's how long we're told these things will take, they spend their 10 minutes on one and, you know, up or down. Is it, is it a URS complaint? Does it belong within the URS? And how do they decide? And they can all send their decisions back to the forum. And, you know, and then two votes wins. And this is, again, a way to have checks and balances and fairness in the process, especially since no one can really define what the elements are at this point, or the special elements for the URS.
Jeff?
And that's just my own short. Is that paid for by the appellant? I'm assuming it is, because that sounds pretty expensive to me.
The original process of just the three-person examiners, the three board examiners, shouldn't be that expensive. We're not talking about that much more time than one examiner. And the appeals process, yeah, we should talk about who pays for that.
Mark.
That's a good question.
I think the proposal to have three people at the initial examination stage is a mistake for this process. It would add expense. It would add time. It would make it more complicated than necessary for dealing with the vast majority of cases that are going through this. I think the safeguards that Kathy rightly is concerned about are best addressed by having the opportunity for the person to respond, by having the site go back up in the case of inadvertent defaults, and having an opportunity for people who do want to defend a case and have legitimate claims for defending it. But what I think, Kathy, that you're proposing for the start is not helpful at the beginning stage, because of the vast majority of cases that would go through this just don't need that level of review.
Okay, thank you, Mark. I don't want to sound like the one-track record here, but I think we all have to keep in mind, as I understand it, the question of a review at all is not in the staff recommendation for rights protection for the URS. So if we are in agreement that there should be some kind of an appeal, the only way we're going to persuade the ICANN board ultimately that they should direct staff to provide for an appeal is to come to some kind of a consensus on what it should be. And I am getting the sense from listening that we're pretty far apart. But I think you ought to understand that, again, the default here is that there won't be an appeal. And maybe that will introduce a sense of realism on both sides of this issue, I hope. Kathy, you have your hand up.
No, sorry, let me take that down.
Okay. Well, let's move on then. We're in agreement that the notice to the respondent should be clear. I don't think we really need to go further on that. The next question is, whether the dispute resolution providers are randomized and how they are randomized. And again, I think that this is an issue where the burden is on us to come to consensus. Olivier, you have your hand up.
Thank you, David. Sorry to come back to the actual notice to respondent requiring to be clear. One thing which has not been considered and which should be considered in the light of the AOC is the fact that there is no mention anywhere of multiple languages. We don't know what language the notice will be written in, and it might be clear if it's written in English to an English-speaking person, but it might not be clear to someone who is not an English speaker. So that's one thing which we wanted to put on record, and we might have to deal with this when we start dealing with the nitty-gritty of operations. But we do recommend that we deal with many languages. Furthermore, also, what happens with with trademarks that are written in other scripts and in Japanese patents, Japanese trademarks. Sorry, these are things that we might need to have a look at. Thank you,
Mark.
If you're going on to the panelist point, I want to add a nuance to what's stated there, which is that the IPC, since our last call, has exchanged some more thoughts about this. And one of the concerns is the willingness of providers to implement something with a randomized pool. We think that the providers or existing providers or prudential providers should be contacted about whether that's practical. And it may be that a better way to deal with the concern of randomization, et cetera, that's designed to do is in an appeal process.
Okay. I think I'm sorry I skipped ahead too fast on the question of notice, and I think Olivier has raised a very important issue when we're talking about all the languages of the world and all the character sets. There clearly is an issue of what constitutes clarity, and I think at the very least we should recommend that the notice should be clear to the person who receives the notice, whatever procedures might be required to do that. I don't see anyone's hand up on that, so let's move on to the panelists. Is anyone? Oh, Olivier. Go ahead.
Thank you, David. One of the things that might have to introduce to who is data or registration data is the preferred language in which the registrant wants to be contacted in. That might clear the language issue.
Very good suggestion. Okay, anyone else on the question of randomization of dispute providers, resolution providers?
Kathy.
Go ahead.
Yep. Just again going back to the key issue for NCSG, which is forum shopping, that this is something that is done in the UDRP and that we absolutely have to prevent in the URS. So however it's practical, randomizing panelists, as Mark suggested, randomizing forums, as we suggested, this should be easily doable. Thanks.
Okay. I think we can move on then. The question of the time of notice, 14 to 20 days, and the various different positions in between that. And this is one where guidebook, the staff proposal, is still 14 days with an extension of time not more than 7 days, and fax notification is included in the notice process. So here again, the default we're faced with is the guidebook proposal, the possible extension of 7 days. Kathy.
Actually, I'm sorry, I didn't put my hand down on that. But the 20-day notice is critical. We're hearing from people in developing countries, our members, and you know, if the spam goes into if the initial notice goes into spam file, the email notice, then the certified letter is not going to get to Cambodia or many other places within the 14 days. The 20 days is a minimum, and then if you have a rapid review, the domain name and the website come down very, very quickly as compared to a UDRP. So 20 days seems very reasonable to us. We'd like more.
Mark?
The IPC in talking this through is concerned about the loss of a rapid decision here. The one of the concerns of that Kathy's raised before is protecting the good actors who don't give notice, and we think that the IRT version did that by having the opportunity for the site to go back up if there was a default. If we look at this in a practical way as to the number of days, and Kathy has said, well, 20-day minimum for a notice, if we followed what the IRT had in mind, there would be 14 days to respond, and then it would go to the panelists to decide. And let's say they took 14 days to decide. Now you're at 28 days, and within that period of time, under the IRT view, if a respondent came back and said, you know, we do have a defense here, we'd like to submit a defense, then they would have that opportunity, and the site would not be taken down, or if it had been taken down, it would go back up. I'm sympathetic. And I know the IPC members are sympathetic to Kathy's concerns about the good faith actors, but as the experience of people who have been dealing with these things is that is a very small portion compared to the very large number of defaults and things that would go through this, and the opportunity to continue to have sites up and making money off them is very troubling to a lot of people commenting on this. So what we would like to see is to hold to the 14 days and find a way to address Kathy's concern for good faith people who don't get a notice. And I think we did that in the IRT report.
Okay. Wendy.
Sure. Just a quick question. I keep hearing the vast majority, the great bulk, are likely to be wrongdoers and or people who should properly be taken down. And I'm just wondering where the numbers and data to back that are found.
John, Mark, do you want to reply to that, or shall we move on?
Well, I think WIPO gave us statistics at the last couple of meetings on this point, and that a very large number of cases these days are defaults, and that of those cases, there's a decision that there was no defense in this case, that this was a parking page based on someone's clear brand name. So I think the numbers that we've been hearing from WIPO are that there's about 70% of these cases go that way.
Okay, John. John Nevis.
John indicates that he just dropped from the call.
Oh. Well, Constantino.
Yes. One point, I have been hearing a lot talking about the default cases, and I appreciate that there is a huge number of default cases, but not all defaults are in bad faith, and we really need to understand that, and this is a problem that has been taken from the UDRP and it has been incorporated in the URS, that all defaults are bad faith. This is not the case. There are some defaults that are genuine defaults. And also to respond to the data submitted by WIPO, WIPO said that the 7% rise, they saw a 7% rise in UDRP disputes. Now, whether that 7% was Cyprus squatting or not is yet to be seen, because no one has actually conducted a proper UDRP review to see whether there is a rise in Cyprus squatting. The fact that WIPO has generated a larger number of UDRP disputes, in my eyes, for example, might mean that it can be forum shopping and not cyber squatting. So I would really like to turn the attention to the fact that not all domain name registrants are in bad faith, and we need to make sure that we give them the appropriate notice to show that they are in good faith. And 14 days is very minimum compared also to other dispute procedures that are taking place online.
Okay, thanks. John, if you're back.
Yeah, thanks. I went to go off mute and I hit off. So I'm not sure if Mark said this, but WIPO presented data to the IRT that 70% of complaints are defaulted. They go unanswered in the UDRP currently. So that was definitely an important figure for us, Wendy, and to answer your question, the vast majority meant 70%. The other thing I wanted to bring up on this point and on point 16 is the BC's comments related to post-launch IP claims. It sounds like from the BC perspective, some issues on 16 and 17 are acceptable in exchange for post-launch IP claims and domain transfer. So I want to get a sense from Zaid, is it an and or an or? Because as you can imagine, post-launch IP claims would add a level of complexity to this process that would be unmatched by anything that's in this proposal and would be wholly unacceptable to the providers.
Can I respond to that, David? This is
Zaid. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Currently, the position is that basically this is a BC position that in negotiations we should have these two placed out there as important elements, both in the IP claims as well as the URS. So it is a negotiating position. A lot of it is subject to negotiations. I will have to go back, and I haven't had a chance to speak to the BC membership to see to what extent we can actually negotiate which aspect, but I think that there is an understanding within the BC that a lot of the things in the STI will lead to compromise depending, you know, on what it looks like at the end of the day does work for trademark holders. So I'm sorry I'm not answering the question directly, but what I'm just saying is that this is the position at the moment. We were trying to negotiate that, but it may be an or. It may also be that, but at the moment I wouldn't want to say much about it.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Kathy.
I'd like to recommend we come back to this one because I just don't think it's as I've been told that the difference between 14 days and 20 days is not that significant to many people. I happen to know it's very significant to, you know, small non-commercial organizations and even large ones operating in other countries. So But the last thing we want is a system where, you know, trademark owners can game things by submitting complaints on the eve of Christmas and when people are going to be out for a week or two. I think this one should be – we also don't want to go with just assuming people are going to default because when people don't default and when they do have the time to respond and even find an attorney to help represent them, which can take time because the trademark owner already has his or her attorney. It's the registrant who has to find one. When they respond, I think the ratio goes down to about 50-50 in terms of winning-losing in the UDRPs. So I'd like to recommend we come back to this one because it's a huge issue for registrants, and I'm not sure it's that big an issue for everyone else, especially if the forums can come up with very quick decision-making processes.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but bear in mind the default is still what staff has recommended. Mark?
I think the comments have been made that I don't need to say a lot more here about this, but I think the default mechanism that the IRT proposed really helps deal with this problem. Letting these things be out there is a financial burden, and probably the majority of these cases to the trademark owner, and you can protect the good faith registrants with the IRT mechanisms. I just wanted to apologize to people. I'm going to have to, in about 5 minutes, sign off from the call.
Okay. Olivier.
Thank you, David. One suggestion which we discussed within our working group at ALAC was one where you might have the site being taken down after 14 days, but the URS only starting 7 days later. So effectively, for those organizations or individuals, registrants that are in a very remote part of the world, the first they might learn about what's going on might be through their own website going down, but as soon as they find this out, they can click on it and basically respond and say, right, we know, we're now informed about what's going on. But the important part being that the URS would only start 7 days later. Is that something which other participants might find interesting?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, that was up from before.
Oh,
could you explain that a little more? What do you mean by the URS starting 7 days later?
Well, at the moment, we're looking at either having a URS process with the whole examination of the claim at either 14 days or 20 days. What we suggest might be that the site gets taken down at 14 days, but that the URS process of examining the claim only starts at 20 days. Or 7 days after the site has been taken down, so it gives some time for the registrant to see that the site is down and to be informed. While at the same time, the site is not out there anymore, still in operation for 20 days.
So, this is John. Sorry, if I may, David, ask a follow-up question.
Sure, go ahead.
Isn't that the fall position that ICANN staff proposed, which is? You have a 14-day time frame to answer, and then you have an automatic right to 7 days if you raise your hand. And
it would mean that you would need to reply, but there it actually gives you the 14 days, cuts the site off, and the 7 days is one where there's no extension that you have to ask for, that a registrant would have to ask for.
It's different.
So it's a bit different.
And anyone else want to speak to this?
Yeah, this is Zahid. Sorry, I wanted to pick that up. If there was a minimum period in which the decision was to be made, and I think this is something that's written on the side in that column, there is a certain period of time that the examiner is supposed to take to render the decision, that could be the 7 days, etc. So effectively...
Okay, thank you.
Wait, did we just lose the end of that? I didn't hear the end of the statement. Did everyone else?
Boss, Zahid.
Zahid got disconnected.
We're going to reconnect him.
Well, while we're waiting, the modes of notice, we seem to have agreement on adding facts, which is the default in any event. Olivier, you have your
hand. Thank you, David. If I could just add to this, I think the main concern for the BC and IPC is that they still want the URS to be rapid. And one thing is if we actually set up times on how long it would take for a claim to be looked at by in the URS process, that at least we've got sort of hard walls as to the amount of time that is taken until the URS takes place, the amount of time that the URS takes place the process actually takes. And so they would have a good idea of how quickly someone would be, a squatter would be taken offline.
Okay. No one else on that? I think we can move down to item 19.
David, it's Margie. Can you clarify? I just wanted to clarify for the notes. What is the agreement on the length of notice?
So there's no agreement on the length of notice. I said there was agreement on mode.
On mode of notice.
Adding facts to the original.
Thank you.
Okay. So the next very much controverted question is the option to transfer. Olivier, did you have your hand up?
Sorry, I'll take it down.
Okay. The option to transfer, I believe, is... Zahid, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. With the option of transfer, basically the BC's position is that it doesn't have to be a transfer per se. It doesn't have to be something that leads to the domain name being actually necessarily at the option of the complainant to be used by the complainant, but it could be some mechanism by which you could pay a fee or you could send it or something could be done by which we just ensure that since it doesn't go back into the pool again, the revolving door issue doesn't arise, and that's what we're looking for. That's what the members are looking for.
Mark?
Yeah, I'd say from the IPC's point of view, if we can resolve that revolving door problem of short registrations that would lapse and then the name would fall back into to another cyber squatter to pick up, that would be a suitable substitute for transfer. And that if somebody does want the transfer, they go to court or they go through a full DRP.
Okay. Jeff?
As long as whatever solution you guys come up with doesn't affect or have any impact on recoding the registries to actually deal with this stuff. So we had this discussion before. I know what you guys want. From my perspective as a registry, I'd rather you just order the transfer immediately. So I'd rather just join that side than to have anyone play with clocks or timing or grace periods or any kind of thing that has to be manually done or hard-coded.
Hey, Jeff Eckhaus.
First, let me echo what Jeff Newman said as a registrar. We do not want that either. And just had a question. This, I guess, is for the IPC on this, or some of the groups that are advocating the transfer. Would you be willing, do you think that the person, the complainant, would be willing to pay for an additional year if they won the URS to say, okay, we're going to add a year on? Or do they, what's the expectations? Because you're saying, I know the issue people have discussed is, after the transfer, after the URS or whatever, there's a short period. Is the intention for them to, at that point, to renew the name themselves? Or what's supposed to happen after that period? And would you want an initial additional year at that time when they won the URS? Just some ideas on there, some questions about that.
Well, this is Mark real quick. I think the goal is so that it just doesn't drop from this process and fall into the hands of somebody else immediately. So I think the idea of renewing it for an additional year in which it's frozen, that seems to me to make sense as a way to deal with this issue. And that would provide sufficient time for the complainant or the registrant to take further action.
The complainant would pay for that. It wouldn't be, that some magical person would pay, because that's I've heard that was an issue. That saying we don't want it to go to drop, but we don't want to pay. So that's one of the things. So if the complainant would pay for that additional year, some standard commercial rate, whatever it is, would that be okay?
Yeah. Well, look, I'm not a brand owner, but I think there are brand owners out there who would say they'd like to have it for free, but I think there has to be a balancing of issues on that, and I think what's fair would be, you know, that there's an appropriate payment for it.
Hey,
this is Zahid. Can I jump in?
Oh. I'm sorry. Who?
Zahid from the BC.
Oh.
I was just thinking, could I just follow up on that?
Okay.
Yep. Okay, thank you. Sorry, just because John mentioned that, you know, those people are advocating this. So the BC is actually, we started this process, and we're glad to see the IPC in some form support it. Yes, to answer the question, it is something we could work with. We understand that there's a balance. We can't actually have that for free. And the real issue we're just trying to solve is the revolving door issue. So if it costs some fee to basically make sure that it doesn't go into the pool, that is something we can work with. Thank you.
Hey, Kathy.
Just two questions so I can understand this a little better, and please accept these questions are in good faith. The first is, what happens if it's a 10-year term on the registration? How is that going to be handled from a registrar perspective, and what would the BC want with that domain name? And the other is, what about if the domain name is a basic word? And maybe one person has registered it in bad faith, but that doesn't mean that if it goes back into the pool, the next person will register it in bad faith. So what about that type of situation? Because, again, this is a domain name, I would think, that someone has chosen not to register during one of the sunrise periods.
This is Zahid from the BC. Should I respond?
Yeah, go ahead, Zahid.
Okay. So the question about the 10 years, the issue is to make sure it doesn't go back to school. And if it, you know, we're looking at a situation where the 10 years is expiring and then we just need to pay an extra fee to make sure that we can ensure that, you know, we renew it, that makes sense. So that, I think that's the straightforward answer, unless I'm not understanding something in the question. The second thing with regard to what if somebody wants to actually have the right to use that name for something completely different. We don't have a solution, or we haven't thought about a possibility in that. If there is something, and this is just really thinking off the top of my head, like the reconsideration mechanism that the IRP proposed for certain, you know, under IP claims, et cetera, that could be something that could make sense, or we could work with that. But I think that may be something that the registries and their processes may be impacted by, so that may not be workable from that perspective. So that's my response to that, but we haven't really given it that much consideration.
Thank you.
Okay. Phil, one question. Your status, are you representing any of the stakeholder groups?
Well, I'm an alternate for the BC, and I'm being very careful not to say anything that's at odds with the BC position. I'm just, if it's okay, if not, I won't say anything, but I just wanted to raise points which I think kind of draw out points for discussion. I'm not trying to advocate a position in my comments, if that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to elaborate on the point Kathy had made, which in thinking about this, if the standard is one of the first element is identical or in some way incorporating a registered mark, and I don't have an answer to it, but there are going to be registered marks which are not generic words where I can, you know, clearly you wouldn't want it going back in the pool because almost any use other than by the authorized, the owner of the mark is going to be infringing. But there are other marks which are, you know, generic words and could go back in the pool and be used in a completely non-infringing way. I don't have a solution to that, but it just, the identity to a mark is just one of the three elements, and in some cases it's almost preordained that the use by anyone other than the holder of the mark is going to be infringing, but in other cases it's not preordained at all that the other two elements would be satisfied for other users.
Okay, thank you. I think we can move on then to the complaint and answer question. This is item number 20. There seems to be substantial agreement, although the details, I think, are still not entirely agreed upon. Is this, again, is an area that I don't believe is covered in the staff recommendation. So the default position is that there would be no limitation, or the limitation, if any, would might be imposed by staff when they put together the details. Does anyone want to speak to this? Well, it's an area where, Olivier, go ahead.
Thank you, David. Following up on my earlier comment, same comment here as well. In what language should the complaint and answer be written in?
Very good question. And I think this is an area where we might be able to come to an agreement and provide something useful for staff. The next item is the question of a successful complaint in obtaining a transfer, and I think this really is the same subject that we have already covered in the item 19, unless anyone feels differently. I think we can skip over that, which brings us to the last point, and we have about 10 minutes left, the question of the review of the URS. And we have, I believe, agreement that regular review is necessary. Does anyone want to speak to this? Well, there may be, Constantino.
Yes, David. I think that I am, NCSG is very much in favor of reviewing the URS, but I think that we need to also incorporate and start playing with the idea of the review of the UDRP. Throughout this discussion, I've heard the two systems being confused a lot, at least in my eyes, and I really think that if we are to create a new system to deal with this, a rapid new system to deal with these clear-cut cases, we need to disassociate as much as we can from the UDRP. Otherwise, we have two systems that can be both gained and can both serve and both serve the same purposes. So we can, you know, the review of the URS can coincide with the amendment of the UDRP, and it can happen at regular intervals, and the URS can exist until we proceed to the appropriate review of the UDRP.
Olivier.
Thank you, David. There is one thing which hasn't been considered there either, which is the criteria for reviewing the URS. How do we measure success or failure? And in addition to that, if we, more importantly, if we see either abuse or some aspect not working, what is the mechanism to quickly revise it? Because under the current ICANN processes, the only way to modify a policy is via PDP, which will typically take a long time, even if all the parties agree, or board action if it's deemed an emergency. But we do have to think of that as well.
That's a very good point, and it's one where the burden is on us to come up with a reasonable proposal that we can agree on that we present to staff and ultimately to the board. Phil.
Yeah, I just wanted to note that I had spoken to this issue at the public forum in Seoul and proposed that there be pre-identification, the type of data that would be collected to provide for regular annual review. Simple things, the number of cases filed, the decisions, how many, the effect on the UDRP. But some data-based methodology for reviewing it and providing both complainants and registrants with assurance that there'd be a regular review process, that the review would be based on hard evidence, and that there'd be a way to adjust the process if it wasn't working out the way either side had contemplated at launch. So,
thank you. at this point, I don't see any other hands up. If Margie is willing to proceed to preparing a very rough straw man draft of the consensus that we are working on, and if the various parties that understand that there is a serious burden to overcome or a burden to bear in order to make a reach an agreement that can be presented to the board. And without that kind of agreement, the default is very clear. It'll be the staff position because that's what the board has said it's going to be. Olivier.
Do we have to agree on all points for the board to take into consideration what we agree on, or do we? Would the board just would the decision revert to the IRT if we don't agree on one point?
No, I don't think we're required to have total consensus on every single point. I think if we have consensus on certain points but not on others, it seems to me the logical approach would be for the staff and the board to accept our consensus on the agreed items and proceed with the staff proposal on those where there is no consensus. Anyone feel differently about that? Well, if not, there will be a call tomorrow. I'm sorry I won't be able to. Oh, Zahid, go ahead. Zahid? No.
David, this is Konstantinos. A very quick question about tomorrow's call. What time is it exactly? Because I think I've received two emails with different times.
Isla, can you answer that?
Yes, absolutely. The call tomorrow, just bear with me for 1 second. The call tomorrow is at 1600 UTC.
1600 UTC.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay, we're almost at the 90 minutes. And
David?
Yes, Kathy, go ahead.
There seem to be a number of areas of agreement. There seem to be a number of areas where there is disagreement but room to discuss and negotiate. The BC has put in a number of issues, as I think John Nevitt pointed out, where they, they're willing to negotiate X for Y. Is anyone interested, and is ICANN staff amenable to creating a face-to-face meeting? Because in the time frame that we're dealing with, one or perhaps two face-to-face meetings may mean we can really iron out the type of details that are important to some of the constituencies. You know, everyone has the issues that are very important to them. If we meet face-to-face, we may be able to kind of put all of this to bed.
Well, Zahid, do you want to comment on that?
Thank you, David. Yes, I think that I think to the extent that we have been able to reach some common ground or agreed on a higher level of certain principles, maybe there's some room for putting sending something as a tentative, and I repeat the word tentative proposal to the GNSO with a placeholder saying that we are still continuing to negotiate the details, and that number one we need more time, and number two I think the idea of having a face-to-face isn't that is really trash out. I think some of the issues may be, this is at least my perception of it, some of the issues may be a lack of understanding between sides about, you know, what works, what doesn't work, and what the concerns might be.
Yeah, I certainly am not opposed to the idea of a face-to-face meeting. I think the logistics are very... very difficult at this point. I'm involved in another working group. Jeff Newman and I are both involved in PPSC developing the PDP procedures, and a face-to-face meeting has been proposed. A doodle has been sent out, and it's enormously difficult. It's pretty clear that no one is going to be available during the forthcoming holiday season, no matter what country you're in. There are winter solstice holidays, however, whatever you call them. Unless we could get some kind of an extension. Margie, do you want to speak to this?
I know we talked about it in Seoul, and I've certainly floated the idea of a face-to-face meeting. We're certainly willing to explore it if that's what the group is interested in, and I'll go ahead and start having conversations internally if that's what you as a group think is important. We do have a bit of calendar constraints because of the holidays. It may be difficult to schedule it, but I'm certainly willing to look into it and get some information for you.
Zahid.
I think that's what I was trying to get at, basically, that we would send something to the JNSO, get an extension of time, and this face-to-face meeting would take place subsequent to that to work out details. The reason being that we have sort of, for lack of a better term, a Damocles sword of the staff proposal hanging over our heads. And maybe if we got that extension and then got that time to sort of, cool the mind, sitting together, trying to work this problem out at a later stage, that might help, and we won't have to deal with that default situation.
Thanks. Jeff Eckhouse, I'll let you have the last word, and then we're
okay, thanks. I think I've, in my emails, I've spoken about how we need to be efficient here, and I just want to reiterate that and say, while I think a face-to-face would be very useful, I still do not think that it would be that useful that it would be worth asking for an extension on this, and that we should still focus on the official timeline and work on the telephone calls and think about a face-to-face as more of a bonus than a necessity for this.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all for your participation. I think we've made some significant progress, and let's hope that regardless of the face-to-face issue, we can continue to work through emails, and if people want to make private telephone calls to each other, please go ahead. So I think that's it. Thanks.
Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, David.